Welcome to another episode of Crying Mo's Tabletop Alchemy. This is episode 13, the magic number. I think it's magic. It might be bad magic. It's good magic. I don't know. It's a magic number, right? 13, come on. All right, I hope everyone's having a great week. This is my podcast about things tabletop gaming related, with an emphasis on miniatures and terrain crafting and anything I happen to want to chat about. I have returned to these hobbies after a quarter of a century, and I'm just super excited to get back into Dungeons & Dragons and Warhammer and all these new skirmish games that are out there. I love collecting miniatures and painting them and making mountains out of Home Depot building materials and rolling dice. Mainly, I'm just stoked to be creating art again in some capacity. You can listen to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Overcast.fm. Tune in, and you can check out the YouTube version where I include footage of either terrain crafting or miniature painting. Comments and ratings are one way to help get the podcast in front of new audience members, so those are always highly appreciated wherever you happen to listen to this or, yeah, enjoy it or whatever. That's always great. You know who else is highly appreciated? My patrons. I hope you guys are all doing well. You know who you are, and I do too. Thank you so much. You can find all the episodes plus show notes with links to things discussed in each episode at cryandmo.com. You can email me at cryandmo@gmail.com. You can message me on Instagram or Facebook. And as always, the intent of this podcast is to have something interesting to listen to while you work on your hobbies. That said, I know I'm not that interesting, which is why I'm working hard to bring you new interviews. And man, have we got a few lined up. I'm excited, and here by request today is one of my best friends. I've known him for almost 30 years. Holy cow. Yep. Wow. All right. Lord Hoffman. He hates that. Trust me. If you've listened to previous episodes of this podcast, you've heard me mention this fellow before. He's basically the guy who not only introduced me to Games Workshop, but has also probably taught me all the basics of model making that I know. He's worked in the Hollywood film industry as a model maker for 20 years. He's one of the tiny number of professionals still managing to hack out a living doing that particular kind of craftsmanship. He's a staggeringly good painter, model maker, and scratch builder. He sculpts and molds and engineers. He's got one of the finest attentions to detail I have ever encountered, and he's just a genuinely nice guy, if you're on his good side, if you know what I mean. All right, I'm done trying to embarrass him. You can find him on Instagram at Talk About Star Wars, and he'll try to put more stuff up on his Instagram account. I keep telling him, put some more of the cool stuff, man. Just put more stuff. Anyway, while he and I could basically fill several hours with model making and game playing talk, I tried to keep our conversation manageable. That said, we probably have a two-parter here, but hey, let's meet him. Are you planning to go to the Star Wars land at all?
I would love to go, but I don't want to pay $100 to get in the park just to see it.
Well, you can also go to Space Mountain. You don't like Space Mountain? We'll go. You and me and Kira, we'll go.
Okay,
I haven't
fine.
I've only been once to Disneyland, yeah. So Kira's only been once. So we'll save up our money and we'll go have a day. But it's for you, it's $300.
Why?
Because you got to buy your lightsaber.
Oh, that's right. The lightsaber.
I mean, that's a $200 lightsaber, but I've watched the videos and how they put that thing together. We talked about that. I think it's actually probably a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I'll have to go look at the videos. I do want that. I have my Graflex lightsaber sitting here where I can look at it.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This guy has a Graflex, which is what... Explain to people what that is.
A Graflex is a flash gun from the 30s and 40s. Well, probably they used them up into the 60s. Before they replaced them, you know, the old style cameras. I'm not an expert. Mine is a beat up one that I got from a friend of mine, which personally I think makes it cooler because it looks used.
Right.
I've seen pristine ones. I was trying to buy a pristine one near where you and I used to work in Culver City, and I had $200 cash on the table and the guy wouldn't take it.
No.
Like literally, I'm like fanning $200 out in front of him. He's going, nope, I can get more on eBay. I'm like, dude.
Tell people what the Graflex was used in.
Okay, so the Graflex, they modified pieces of it. They took the main Graflex handle, removed a couple of, like they removed the flash.
Like the flash head or whatever.
Yeah, the flash reflector and the head. And then they used the barrel, the body of it. Is once you take that flash reflector head off of it, the body of it, it's pretty obvious what it is. You see it. And then they use, I'm going to piss some experts off out there, but I don't really care. They use windshield wipers from a British military vehicle.
Okay. And
some other pieces, they're part of a Texas Instruments calculator for the Switch, and a few other goodies.
Yours looks a little different, but the graphics you're describing, the prop that was made was specifically Luke Skywalker's first lightsaber, right?
Yes. It's the lightsaber that Obi-Wan gives him in the, I'm not going to call it episode 4.
A New Hope.
Yes. So when Luke gets that lightsaber, that is a Graflex. And the Darth Vader lightsaber is built out of another flash holder, but it's not a Graflex.
Oh.
It's the competing brand. There was another camera brand around the same time.
Okay.
And it's similar in design, but it's not similar in construction. So yeah, like the basic idea of it's the same, but it's got, I don't think they're plastic, but the parts of it are black. So it may have been like a coating over metal. I've actually never handled a real one, so I don't know. Mine is, I decided to make sort of my own version of it because that's what I do. The windshield wipers for the handle are off my MR2, which I thought was kind of fun.
It's obviously not the whole windshield wiper, right? Like, what is
it? No, it's just they cut a piece of it.
Oh, I see.
4 inches long. So you've got 6 of them around the base that gives it like a grip.
Yeah.
So you cut those, I'd say they're 4 inches long, 3.5, 4 inches long. I used parts of my Wave Serpent that I custom built and a piece of track link from a Yog Tiger for the Switch. The emitter is a wheel and tire from a 24 scale Lamborghini Countach, which actually looks pretty cool. And I found out later one of their actual props uses something very similar, but I hadn't seen that at the time. And I used a couple of pieces from the Necron, the green laser tube that they give you.
Yeah.
I used a couple of cut pieces of the sprue around the outside. It has this weird sort of, it's not round, it's a weird shape. And by cutting it, there's two tab or prongs, I guess, where the flash screen or shield would fit, probably where the wires went in. But those Necron things pressed in there just perfectly. So it looks like it's got these two translucent green. I don't know what they would do exactly on a real lightsaber, but they're there on mine. So I thought, okay, that's pretty cool.
So, all right, this is all excellent stuff. But I forgot to do something here at the beginning. Tell us who you are. Tell us your name. And what you're famous for.
What I'm famous for? Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
It does, yes. It really, really does. My name is John Hoffman, and I am famous for, I guess I would consider myself most well-known for being a professional movie model builder.
Very nice. That's perfect. And, I'll preface this whole thing by telling people that we should all address you as Lord Hoffman.
Oh, I knew you were going to do that, you bastard.
Okay. All right. Here we go. So I got my list of questions. We're going to get back into these models and game stuff and all this interesting stuff. But I like to do this for all the interviews because I think it's interesting. If you can remember all the way back to when you were 10 years old, at that age, what did you think you were going to grow up to be or do as a career?
At 10 years old, I thought I was going to be a fighter pilot.
Excellent. All right. Back then, was there a particular plane that you thought you were like, oh, I'm going to fly this plane or whatever? I remember when I was like 12 or whatever, I was all about F-16s.
Yeah, I'm a little older than you. So for me, it would have been an F-4.
Sure.
Or
Phantoms.
A Phantom or a Tomcat, an F-14.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't actually made up my mind what branch of the service I was going to join.
Oh, right.
That wasn't really, I wasn't concerned about that. It was that this looks cool and that looks cool.
Yes.
And then Star Wars came along and ruined my whole plan. So,
what is one thing you're really interested in that is not hobby or game related or model making related?
Formula One racing.
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay, man. So getting to the official questions. Here we go.
All right.
All right. What was your last film job project?
That would have been the Leica film Missing Link.
Missing Link. And what did you do for that? That's
all
stop motion.
I made miniature. Yeah, it is. All stop motion. I made miniature props and one vehicle.
Nice. Yeah, it's very cool, man. Give me before I get into the next sort of meaty question, can you just rattle off like sort of a list of films that you worked on? I know you worked on a bunch of commercials and stuff too, but I think we're just interested in like some movie titles.
All right. Titanic, Dante's Peak, Star Trek, which Star Trek was it? It's one of the Next Generation ones and it's awful, but I worked on it. It's Nemesis, Star Trek Nemesis.
Oh, Nemesis, yeah.
It's horrible.
Well, we worked on a lot of horrible movies.
Yeah, a lot of horrible movies. Chronicles of Riddick. Actually, that's one of my favorite movies I worked on. It's not a great movie, but it's fun.
Yeah, no, it's totally fun, yeah.
I worked on Kubo, which I like that a lot, although the movie is not that great. Well, I got to build a samurai sword. There's more detail in that sword than there's any right to be on film, and no one stopped me from doing it, which is one of the crazy things about working over there is they kind of encourage you to do stuff that's way past what you'll ever see on film.
Yeah, so they can take their close-up shots at the end of it.
Well, that sword breaks down in a lot of ways like a real katana. It has parts on it that don't need to be separate that I made separate to try to make it easier to paint.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because I was trying to push the limit of what I could do just to see, like, okay, can I actually make this tiny little piece and get them to mold it and then get a usable part from the mold room and put it on here? And it's pretty crazy.
This, ladies and gentlemen, sums up Lord Hoffman.
Well, okay, so I'll give you a little detail. When they sent me the drawing of that sword, one of the goals unofficially in the model shop is to sneak things into parts and props from other films. So some people try to sneak their names in, which is bullshit, and you shouldn't be doing that. But other people try to sneak in like little reminders or cues from other films. So when the designer sends me the drawing, the prop list or prop drawing sheet for that particular sword, there's an item called a Manuki. I'm probably mispronouncing that, and hopefully I got the name right. But what it is a little, I want to call it a jewel, but that's not really the right word. It's a little sculpted piece that fits under the wraps, which I can't remember the name of the wrap. But that silk wrap that covers the shark skin on the hilt of a samurai sword, there's a little, sometimes it'll be a family emblem, or it's something personal to that particular samurai. And it's part of every one of those swords past a certain point. Like, I don't know when they started doing it, but they all had it past a certain point. So he drew on that build sheet, very specifically, the SETI Alpha 5 eel from Star Trek 2.
Oh.
That's the Manuki. And I sculpted a tiny little, I matched that thing. It's tiny. And once it's under the wraps, you can't see it at all. Like, it just might as well not be there. But it is there.
Yes, this also sums up Lord Hoffman's work. Creating detail where none needs to be, it's spectacularly cool.
We had to make a couple other swords, like different. There's a shot of the actual Otakuro monster has a bunch of swords sticking out of its head.
Oh, right.
So we had to make a bunch more swords, and I made several swords from other movies. So the Kill Bill, the bride sword is in there.
Oh, that's cool.
The Highlander sword is in there. They didn't paint them. Like, everything got painted brown, so
right. You
never know they're there.
Sure.
That was one of the things I was not happy. Anyway, but the Manukis on several of those swords, one of the Manukis is a Millennium Falcon.
How big in centimeters or inches is the actual full sword, the Kubo sword?
Okay, so the Kubo sword is probably 7 inches long.
Tip to hilt,
the end of the hilt. There were different scales. The one that I'm talking about, I made the Otakuro sword, which is the one that he pulls out of the hand. That sword was about 8 inches long. So the Manuki, I think the SETI Alpha 5 eel was maybe 3/16 long.
Oh, man, that's too cool. And that thing was all, what was it made out of material-wise, the sword itself?
Okay, so the sword, the blade, I carved the blade out of a piece of styrene. That's material I'd like to use. I knew they were going to mold it and cast it in resin, so it didn't really matter what I made it out of. It was just something that was easy for me to shape. So I figured styrene would be the fastest way to do it. Pretty much all of it is styrene. I used sandpaper for the shark skin on the hilt, and everything else was styrene. And then it all gets cast in resin.
So they can make multiple copies, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Did you paint those, or that goes to a paint department? Or
I did not. Another guy painted them. I forget who painted them, but they have an electroplating setup over at the shop. So the swords were chrome plated.
Oh, nice. Wow.
And then they masked off the Hamoon line, and that was painted on after that.
And that's the like the sort of wavy metal, like at the edge of the, tempering or whatever that you see in samurai swords.
Yes.
Man, that's cool. Like, we can go down rabbit holes with like pretty much every project that you worked on. So I'm going to try to keep us moving a little bit into different topics. So I would like you to tell me another story. This is basically story time with Hoffman. Starting work at Vision Crew, and on your first day, maybe it wasn't your first day, but to me, it sounds better if I say it like this. On your first day, you show up and you're like, hey, you guys are doing this at the wrong scale.
I knew you were going to do this.
This is great, though. This is a, this is a great story.
Well, it kind of means throwing someone under the bus. So I won't use their name.
No, you don't. Yeah, you don't have to do. Well, whatever. I mean, the bottom line is somebody made a mistake and you caught it. But without being, I don't want you. This is not about that particular part. It's just about, tell me a little bit about your first job on Titanic. But that's an interesting story to me.
All right. So the first day I show up, I have my model building toolkit, which turns out not to be anywhere close to adequate.
Right. I remember that too.
Probably your first day, you probably realized that, I don't have anywhere near the tools.
Yeah. Dude, my first day was like, what do you mean that's a model? That's way too big.
Well, okay. See, I was prepared for that because I knew more about this going in. So they show me the plans. They have plans on the wall for the part of the ship that I'm supposed to work on. And the plans are in 24th scale.
And this is for Titanic, the main, like the actual Titanic, right?
James Cameron movie.
Yeah.
So we have a section of the ship. There's a blueprint in 24th scale, but the model is being built in 20th scale. And the boss, he tells me, all right, so this is what you're going to build. It's going to be 20th scale. And I wrote that down, pretty sure, but I didn't need to. I mean, that locked into my brain because it's like, okay, this is a scale model. Here we go. At some point, I'm going to have to borrow tools from him. But initially, I just start making my calculations for how big the part is going to be.
What is the actual part, by the way, the particular thing you started to work on?
So what I started to work on was going to be a ladder that would go up. It's mounted on the side of one of the crane bases.
Oh, right. These are the cranes that are on the top deck of the Titanic.
Correct.
Right?
So the base of the crane is essentially a big steel drum. And then the crane is mounted on top of that so it can rotate. And that's what they use to pick cargo up out of the hold or put cargo in the hold.
Okay.
And the Titanic has four of them. Two at the front, two at the back. Bow and stern.
Right.
We're getting crazy about it.
Be correct.
Yes. Let's be correct. So the crane drum is about 6 inches high, and they're about 8 inches across. And I have one sitting there that they've already made. So I know how tall it needs to be. I go get my numbers off of the blueprint. Because at some point in my semi-dodgy scholastic career, I had been doing drafting. So I knew how to look at a blueprint. I knew how to read it. So getting the information off it was not a problem. Go back to my desk. Borrow a calculator from someone because I didn't have a calculator. Never occurred to me as a model builder. Okay, I should back up and restate this. When I was a model builder, up to this point, it hadn't occurred to me that model kits were wrong. I never looked at them from the standpoint of, well, you guys screwed this up somewhere and I have to find it and fix it now, which I think is a pretty standard thing with like guys that build high-end scale models. That's one of the things they do. With the internet, you know ahead of time pretty much what's wrong because someone's found it and it's been posted about 900 times. But back in the day when I was building stuff, I didn't have calipers. I didn't measure anything. If something excessively thick, I would thin it out. But primarily, I just took the kit out of the box, put it together, painted it, moved on to the next one. So it never occurred to me to have a calculator. It never occurred to me to have, I didn't even know how to read a caliper when they first handed it to me. It's like, what the hell is this? I sit down at my desk. I start doing math to do the scale conversion, and that takes me way longer than it should have because I haven't used math like this in years.
Because you're going from 24 scale drawing to 20th scale model on your desk.
It turned out that it wasn't as difficult as it sounds because apparently I'm better at math than I give myself credit for. But it, so I get a number and I look at that number and I run the math a couple more times because the number doesn't seem right. And then I go measure the drawing again because I'm not getting what's happening is my ladder is too big to fit on the crane. It's taller than the crane. So I run the numbers again a bunch of times and I try different combinations of like, okay, well, what am I doing? Because I don't assume at this point that someone else has.
Right. Why would you? It's your first day, right? You're like, yeah, right. I'm doing something wrong.
Yes. Well, maybe one of the things I'm famous for now is assuming people are making mistakes before they have a chance to do it. But let's move on.
Yes.
So I run these numbers a bunch of times and then I go to the guy who built the crane because I can't come up with a way to fix this. And it's starting to dawn on me that maybe the problem isn't with me. It's what they built already.
Right.
And I go talk to this guy and he does not want to talk to me. He's like not interested in like, he's just because I'm interfering with him listening to the Toys soundtrack every day. It turned out every day. So I'm interfering with the Toys soundtrack. And I said, look, this ladder won't fit on the crane. And my numbers aren't working. Could you tell me what you did?
Yeah.
And he just looks at me like, okay, how much stupider can you be? And he points at the drawing and says, all the numbers are right there. And I know at that point, it's like, okay, well, you built the crane to the wrong scale.
Oh, man. And how much had been built to the wrong scale at this point, do you think?
Well, that shop was building all of the deck fittings for the 20th scale model that Digital Domain was building. They had several weeks worth of stuff built. I don't know the exact number.
That's enough. That sums it up. Several weeks worth of work has been done apparently at the wrong scale.
So I go back to my desk and I sit there for maybe half an hour trying to figure out what I'm going to do because I don't really have any idea how I'm supposed to fix this problem now. And if I had known the guy that I was working for, like 6 months later, I would have known exactly what was going to happen.
Sure.
Right. But I didn't know right now. So I had to go talk to him to borrow a micro torch because we were going to solder this ladder together out of brass. So it's all brass soldered together to make the ladder, which I've never done that before, but I kind of know how to do it. So I go to talk to this guy. I don't know how to explain the layout of the shop, but I catch him kind of away from the actual model shop area. So it's maybe 100 feet away. And I find him and it's like, okay, well, I got my numbers. I know what I'm going to build. I'm all set. I need to borrow that torch. And I'm going to build it in 24th scale because everything else is 24th scale. And he looks at me and goes, no, we're building it in 20th scale.
To clarify, you're now talking to basically the owner of the shop, right?
Yeah. So I tell him, okay, well, I'm going to build it in 24th scale because that's what everything is built in.
Right.
And he says, no, we're building it in 20th scale. And I said, well, that's not what they've got. And he literally just runs. Like, I'm just left standing there. It was like something out of one of those Bugs Bunny cartoons where the one character's standing still and the other one makes a smoke trail.
Right, that's a smoke puff. Poof.
And he's just gone. And then the next, like, hour and a half, it's just them looking at, like, just, and now, you know, just this nightmare starts unfolding. And I'm just standing there like, oh.
The nightmare starts unfolding from Hoffman's first day on the job. Oh my goodness. And so basically everything had to be rebuilt, right?
Yeah.
That is still one of my favorite stories. It'll always be one of my favorite stories. I feel bad for those guys because that's a bunch of work that had to be redone. That's terrible. But it's still funny.
One of my favorite stories that you may not know this one, but I built for those same cranes. I made these tiny little, there's a ventilator that goes on the side of that crane. Titanic was my first job, and it probably was good that it was my first job because I didn't have the sensibility yet to know when something didn't need to be perfect or super detailed.
Right, right.
Like, a lot of stuff never gets built to the crazy level that model was built. And they knew they were going to donate it to a maritime museum. I believe it's in San Pedro. But that model was donated to a museum, and it's a museum-grade model. It's insane the amount of detail on that model. And it's beautiful. When you see it up close, it is a beautiful model.
A lot of times for film, you're building, you know, if you're going to build a model of spaceship, you might be like, well, there's one hero side. Like, we're only going to shoot it from this side. So you don't have to build the other side. You know, that's just a crass example. But
so I built these little ventilators that go on the cranes, and they're built out of half-inch brass tube that I cut down. So they're about an eighth inch tall. And then there's another tube that fits inside of them. So it's like a baffled. It has a baffle on the outside that I guess would stop seawater from getting in, but allows air into the crane. And I think there's two on a crane, so there was eight of them total. And I made all of them. We cast them. Each one had a brass ring, though, that had to be fitted to it because that brass ring is too fine. The mold would pick it up, but the resin would never fill it in properly. It's just too thin. So it would have just, anyway, so it gets this brass ring put on it. There's all these hoops you have to jump through to put it together. And then I put them on a little board with some double stick tape so the painters can paint them and weather them and get them ready. And it's marked what it is. And all that stuff went to digital.
Digital domain.
Digital domain, yes. Yeah. So all of that stuff went over there. Some of them assembled before they went over. It depended on what the part was and how it was going to be presented. But
the actual ship model over at digital domain in that hangar, the ship model, it's like 40 feet long. Right?
Yeah, it's
huge.
The first time I saw it, I couldn't appreciate how big it was. I was seeing it from across the room, and it didn't have the upper decks on it yet. It was just the hull. And I'm looking at it thinking, oh my God, that thing's huge. And then some guy stands up from out of inside of it. And then like all of a sudden now it snaps into scale, like how big that thing really is. Because they had hired actual boat hull builders to build the hull.
Oh, right.
So guys working inside of it while people were working on the outside, putting on the rivets and stuff. And I couldn't initially see anybody until this guy stood up. 6 months later, when we're working on another job, one of the leads on the Titanic was working at our shop. So he's there and he's looking for something in his toolbox that he wants me to use on some specific tool that he thinks is going to make my life easier. And he's digging, rifling through his toolbox, and all of a sudden this board pops up with all those crane ventilators. And they're all painted, weathered, and sitting there. And I was like, hey, what is that? And he looks at me and goes, oh, yeah, we didn't have time to put those on. Like, yeah, it's all filmed and gone. And so after several choice words, I took that thing away from him. And I have it to this day.
Nice. One thing I remember you making that turned out, I still think it was one of the more spectacular things that you made. I mean, a lot of what you made was spectacular, but this one, I just remember this being this was a model where it was like this particular part. I remember thinking initially, it's one of those things you look at and you go, well, that shouldn't be that hard to make, but the actual making of it was pretty difficult. And it was the tire for that third scale Humvee for Dante's Peak.
Yeah, that was a real pain. It was actually really difficult. And I remember when they brought that to me, the day that they handed that to me, and I was just looking at them like, you want me to do what?
Because what you ended up making was a single part that became a buck for a mold, so we could mold up multiple tires out of rubber so the thing could actually roll around, like drive around like a real car.
Yes, yes. It's an elastomeric resin. It took several tries to get the mix right because it had to have enough bounce to look like an inflated tire, but it had to be strong enough to carry the weight of that Humvee. And if I remember right, those Humvees were around 120 pounds.
Yeah, they were big. I remember it easily needed two people to pick it up and, you know, the frame and drag it around or whatever.
They were third and a half scale, so they were 1.35, which is a digital domain thing. Everything that anytime we built anything big for them, other than the Titanic, it was 1.35. It's like, why not just 1/4? Why are you making math hard?
Right. It does seem really weird. I remember you made, so you like sculpted is a relative term, but you sculpted each of the, I don't know what the word is for these, but so a tire has this pattern in it, but the pattern basically is made with these, the tread. And the tread, to make the tread, you made just individual blocks. These weird shaped blocks that you lined out, right, on this long rectangular. It's like as if you took the tire, cut it, and then unrolled it to be flat. But then to make the actual product, to make the thing, Hoffman cast this whole long flat tread in resin, but he has to bend the resin over the round circular buck he's already like sculpted out of wood or something. But he's got to do it while the resin is green. Like, that means the resin is half, like...
It's not fully cured.
It's not fully cured, so it's, like, bendable. And it's hot, and it, I don't know, man. That was just crazy.
Yeah, it was...
There's all kinds of geometry in there that I would never be able to figure out.
Well, I didn't think I could figure it out either. I kept looking at the math, and I was always... That job was very stressful, because every day I would look at it like, this is not going to work. And the same guy, the main guy, that's just, oh yeah, it's the work, it'll be fine, you just keep going. You know, that's because, I mean, he was always very encouraging, but he had to be, because he had things had to keep going forward.
Right.
So he always put this very positive spin on, like, I'm sure he would go around the corner where I couldn't see him, and he'd just be like wringing his hands, like, all the guys gonna,
yeah. This is never going to work. I'm going to be doomed. And another one I remember that was super, I mean, you made so many nice models. I got, like, for me, when I think that Hoffman is expert at doing highly detailed, finely crafted miniatures, basically. I mean, he does all kinds of stuff. I mean, I've seen you carve giant styrofoam rocks, you know, for dinosaur or whatever, all kinds of stuff. But, you know, I was thinking of that space shuttle you made that had all the fiber optics in it. I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember what scale that was. It's pretty small.
Yeah, I have a story about that, too. You might want to edit it out. I'm going to tell it.
All right, we'll lay it out. Talk to us about the space shuttle.
That space shuttle is for Species 2, and the deal was we get the original drawing, which I forget what scale it was.
It's pretty tiny, man. I mean,
it was pretty tiny.
It's like about 18 inches long, right? The whole thing.
Yeah, the space shuttle is 72nd scale. So it started out as a Revell kit that we bought. One of the things that happens with blueprints, special effects blueprints anyway, is the draftsman will draw the plan view, and then he'll draw the elevation view, but they won't draw them the same size. And they don't know why they do that, because they'll fit on the same piece of paper. But he got the original drawing. The spaceship looked like the spaceship from Event Horizon. We start building our mock-ups of it, and we didn't get too far into the mock-ups. A mock-up basically is a simplified model so that someone who's not familiar with looking at a blueprint can see what it is that's going to be built and have an idea of, like, okay, well, this is where the difficult areas are going to be. We didn't get very far in that process before the production company pulled the plug on that model. The main reason, it seemed like, was they found out they could rent a space shuttle interior from a prop house. Everything was being done on the cheap on that film, not surprisingly. So they come back to us with this new drawing of, all right, well, we want to build this thing that sort of looks like a cube made up out of girders. And at one point, one side of it, there's a space shuttle hanging off of it with a connecting tube for the crew. There's no way to build that model for the... Well, first of all, that model was way more complicated than what the original bid was for, because they weren't offering to pay more money. They wanted to stay within the original bid. But the main problem... So when you're building a model to be filmed, it has to have an armature. And the armature is the framework that lives inside the model that allows you to attach it to a stand or a motion control rig.
So it can be filmed.
Exactly. So like a classic model, like the X-Wing from Star Wars, that model has four points that you can attach it to a motion control rig, or attach it to a C-stand or something to hold it up while you're filming it. The model that they were asking us to build now, there was nowhere to put anything like that. It would not have worked from a practical standpoint of, like, well, where do we get a hold of this thing? Because it's all open. It's all open truss work except for one pod where the lander is supposed to go and the space shuttle. My boss shows up at my desk one day and he's like, so you like to draw. Can you draw us a spaceship? Could you design a spaceship? I just start, you know, in my brain, it's like the little character from the Legos movie going, spaceship, spaceship. Yes, I can do that. So I went and I drew a spaceship with a space shuttle as the command module and all of the other things that we had been told we needed. Because one of the things we knew was going to happen at that point was it was going to have big cylindrical fuel tanks so they could put all the product placement labeling on the spaceship.
I mean, that's one thing they knew for sure. Okay, we need a space to put, you know.
We knew they're going to have cylindrical fuel tanks. Because later, one of the guys questioned me on the design. It's like, well, why aren't these spherical? Because spherical tanks are stronger. That's what you want.
Right. In space, you'd have a sphere. Yeah.
Well, just in general, but oh. Yes, in space. But no, we're going to have cylindrical because logos.
Because logos. Wait, so is the thing that we actually built, that we actually filmed for the movie, that is your design?
Yes.
Dude, that's cool. I didn't realize. I mean, I must have known it at the time. I just am not remembering.
I think you did.
I mean, that's a pretty good portfolio thing, man. You designed it for film, and it got used. Like,
well, we sent my design in for their approval. Their designer added some that my original design only had one box for the lander. There's like a box behind the. You'd have to look at the spaceship.
Sure.
Don't watch the movie; it's horrible. But
you can see our models in that movie in the first 10 minutes.
Exactly.
And then you can turn it off. Yeah, you don't have to watch the movie.
So he sent it back with a second box. So now the lander takes off from one box, but it comes back and lands in another box. Yeah. And then he added a bunch more truss work to it and another set of solar panels. So my original design had a set of solar panels because that was another element that they wanted. He, to balance it out, added these other truss works that come off the side and come out. So it's sort of cruciform shape now. If you saw it in plan view, it looks like a cross.
Right.
And it has more solar panels. And that model was such a nightmare to film because constantly the original grips that they had were not, they hadn't worked. Well, okay, let's back up. None of the grips that they hired had any kind of clue how to work around a model. So they were constantly sitting there like, just, okay, I got to be here waiting to keep this guy from knocking the model apart.
And I mean, I remember like all that truss work. It was all just, I mean, it was just tiny soldered brass, like just feet of it. Like it was just the tiny thing. And then at the front end is the space shuttle, right? It's sort of sitting in this bracket at the front. I don't remember if the whole thing is lit with fiber optics, but I know the space shuttle is lit with fiber optics.
Yeah, the spaceship itself had tiny fluorescent bulbs.
Oh, that's right.
Which were a nightmare because they didn't work very well and they weren't super reliable and they weren't very bright.
They were, I just remember I had one, I took one home. They were just cool to like hook up to a battery. I mean, they were literally like 2 and 3 inches long and maybe an eighth of an inch in diameter. These little tiny fluorescent bulbs.
Well, see, now what we probably would do is LEDs.
Sure.
The LEDs are very reliable and the new generation LEDs are very, very bright and they're color stable, I think is the word that we want. So they film better.
Yeah.
But at the time, they weren't ideal. So we weren't going to use LEDs. And I did not design the electronics on this model. So I don't really know why they picked fluorescent tubes other than to make my life hell on stage when I had to support the model. So back to the space shuttle. The space shuttle started out as a Revell 72nd scale space shuttle. We built, I modified the cockpit is longer. I guess what you'd call the crew cabin module at the front. I extended that back maybe 3 inches to make it look like there was more crew space. And then, so that meant shortening the doors that open up.
So the model, so you didn't extend the entire model. You just extended that cab within the space of the model.
The shuttle stayed the same overall length as it would have been originally. Because here's the thing, they wanted a shot of it landing. They were able to use stock footage of the space shuttle landing. So we couldn't change, the dimensions of the shuttle couldn't change. But they could get away with changing the doors because they figured no one would catch that. And in reality, it didn't really work that they're lit all differently. It's pretty obvious if you're paying attention that it's not at all the same vehicle. I mean, I think the shuttle model turned out really pretty good, but overall, it just does not look like the stock footage. Because we couldn't use NASA markings on the space shuttle. NASA doesn't want to be part of this turd of a movie. So the other problem is the space shuttle has to be able to separate from the main ship. And they want to do this practically. So in camera, the model is going to be on a motion control rig. And the space shuttle is supposed to drop away. And the doors have to close. Like all this stuff has to happen in camera. So I needed a way to be able to bolt the space shuttle to the model, and then have it at some point where I could remove it so that it could do this the dropping away scene. So I turned sort of like a habitat module that would fit in the shuttle bay, turned that out aluminum. That has the the pickup point for the space shuttle inside of it. And I forget where the other pickup... Oh, there's a pickup point in the nose so that the front nose cap was made to pull off so that you'd reach in through the nose to get the other attachment point so we can hook it up to the motion control rig and pull it away.
You had to use these little tiny Allen wrenches to tighten the machine screws to put that nose mounting thing in there, I remember.
Yeah, none of that was going to be a problem because I knew I was going to be on stage support for the model, so I wasn't too worried about... I knew they were going to send me with the model. Didn't really try to design things that other people would be able to use because I knew it wasn't going to happen. So I didn't worry about, like, if it was a model that we were building and we were going to hand it off to somebody, I would try to make it as simple as possible to get to things and make it obvious. But on this one, I didn't worry about that because I knew that nobody else was, and I didn't want anyone else messing with it because that means things get broken.
Right. Of course.
That model is getting filmed. There's a beauty pass coming over the cockpit where you're supposed to see all the fiber optics I put in.
Just real quick, explain the idea of multiple passes.
So what they'll do is they do a matte pass so that they can digitally remove all the motion control rigs and all that stuff.
So on that pass, I think photographically, or if you were to walk on stage, you would see like the background like lit up, but the model would be dark, right?
Yes.
So that when they do the film, it's like this black, it's a silhouette, essentially.
Yes, silhouette.
And that becomes one layer in, this is all done on film, right? None of this was digital. So they would then reload the film, and then they would shoot another pass. And
right, then they would shoot a lighting pass, which would be a really long, slow pass, so that the lights burn in as much as possible.
Yep, long exposure, basically.
Right, so yes, long exposure, so that you don't have to go back and try to digitally mess with the lighting.
Right.
Although they're probably going to do some of that anyway. But you want as long, slow pass as possible. So one of the passes on one of the lighting passes we did was 8 hours. That was a nightmare.
Yeah.
And I've heard of longer ones. 8 hours was the longest one I ever had to sit through. But during that beauty pass or the matte pass of the space shuttle, when we built it, the kit windows were too thick and not clear enough for the lighting to work, we thought. So I made new windows out of 16th inch plex. They're all fitted, it turned out really, really clean and nice. But during that matte pass, someone, our host possibly, taped up those windows so that they wouldn't reflect. And then during the lighting pass, they didn't take the tape off, so you never see any of those lights. There was a while that I wanted to murder you.
Hey, man, I was good at my job sometimes. That's actually the job that I ended up quitting. The whole thing.
It is.
Yeah, it was not.
I don't
not
really fun. Blame you because that job was horrible. Pretty much the model building itself was fun, but the stage time on that model was.
Yes,
it was
horrible. And stage time wasn't ever really something that we did like a lot of. That wasn't like a normal thing. And it certainly wasn't a normal thing to go like, okay, you're going to go work at this stage now for the next like month and a half.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute, that's not what? Anyway, whatever.
Yeah. But you know what? The crew that's sitting in the shuttle that we never actually see, they're Ral Partha D&D figures.
Oh, that's right. I forgot you did that too.
The kit doesn't come with, that particular model didn't come with astronauts. And they were in different, they didn't have actual spacesuits on with the uniform they're wearing, but it's not really, anyway, but that, yeah, you specifically bought Dungeons & Dragons miniatures because they were close to the right size. We could bend them around to get them to fit in the seats.
Okay, I remember you painting that model. I mean, you did a lot of paint work for a lot of miniatures that I saw. And you do a lot of painting of your own stuff. How does it differ? Does it differ in how you approach a paint job for camera, for a film, versus how you might do something for display at home?
Yes. For stop motion film, like the stuff they do at Leica, they're painted closer to a display model. Or in a lot of cases, they are. Technically, the puppets and stuff that Leica builds, they are display models. Those things get sent out on tour. And a lot of the detail that gets put in them eventually ends up, it's way past the point of what you need on film. Just because, and I don't know, no one's ever told me that they do this, like they think it through like this, but it's just insane the level of detail these things get, and you don't see it in film. So it changed a lot with high definition cameras. You see things a lot better now you see things you wouldn't see before. The paint jobs had to change, but the early stuff that we were doing, like the Species Shuttle, had a lot of what they, what I understood was called carding, where basically you just take a post-it note or a piece of cardboard or something and you hold it up against the model and you spray around the edge and it makes a little shadow.
Oh, yeah. So you get like weird, the implications of panel lines, sort of.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You imply panel lines or panel differences in panels.
Right. But the resolution is never sharp enough to where you're going to go, oh, that's not actually an indentation. Like, or, right. You know, we don't see scribe lines or anything.
Exactly. You wouldn't see scribe lines. Like at one point when we were working on that model, like I was on stage and the producer asked me, well, why doesn't this have all the tile lines scribed into it? And I just looking at him, are you insane? It would have taken a year for one thing and right. Never going to see them. The problem, and you can see this in the first three Star Wars movies, the TIE fighters change color every movie. So the first movie, the TIE fighters are very light gray, and with the black wing panels, they're not going to be able to light them right. You're either the wings aren't going to show up, or that light gray blows out, and it makes it really hard to photograph. So the next one, they're C. It's a specific Patrick color called Stormy Blue, and they're kind of a blue-gray color, which evidently they decided was too dark, because when you get to Jedi, they're a different color now. They're kind of in between. The problem we had on the Species model with the space shuttle is I painted it white because it needs to be white. It probably should have been light gray. I was still pretty new, so I didn't know that. But they ended up doing so much carding on it to kill that white down, because the rest of the spaceship was light to medium gray. And to get the lighting properly on the spaceship, the shuttle was all blown out.
So I know you as the guy who will freeze frame the dogfight in Star Wars so that you can make sure that the X-Wing model you're building is specifically matching the bits, the greeblies, the details are matching what you see in the film. Why do you care so much about this crazy accuracy in these fantasy models or any of these models where you're like, I'm not saying this in a way like as an appreciation thing. I'm wondering just like, what is it about that you really, because you like doing that even for World War II models. Like there's this whole thing of accuracy in the details, in these specific micro details that a lot of people, as you said, you know, not like on film you won't see it, but a lot of people look at a model like an X-Wing, they buy it from Revell and it's like, yeah, I built it, I got an X-Wing. But you'll be like, yeah, but this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong and that paint job is wrong and that's not the one that was in this scene. And you're going to build one and you make it look exactly right. Where does that come from?
I guess because I'm a detail-oriented person. I like and I'm going to back up, and there are guys out there, like the prop replica guys, who are way crazier about those studio scale models than I am. I don't, sure. Like, I get where you're going with this, but I don't do that as much with the Star Wars models. Like the stuff I have, the little ones I painted, I try to get some of the big, like the B-Wing that I did that's on Instagram. I found photographs, that model is a different paint job than the standard B-Wing. And it may be a different scale. I'm not sure about that. It seems like it when you look at photographs, there's some things that are different. The idea is that I picked out a couple of key points that, like, okay, they carded it here. So I matched that on the scale model. But a lot of that stuff doesn't translate. Well, some of those paint jobs on the original, especially the New Hope models, they're pretty fast and loose. So if you're building a display model and you're trying to copy that fast and loose style, especially in a model that's much smaller, it's maybe not going to come off looking the way you want it to. I think there has to be some adjustments made. I always build things like my models. I always build them with the back of my mind that this model is going to go into a contest at some point. Like coming back to the detail stuff, most of that detail craziness I put into my military models because I try to base them on photographs of an actual specific vehicle.
When you say a specific vehicle, you don't mean the general specificity of this is this type of vehicle. You mean this is this vehicle that's in this photograph.
Correct. Yeah. So yes, that is a specific Mustang or a specific tank. The example I'm using is a specific Mustang that belongs to a specific fighter group, had the noses painted blue. You can see in the photographs of this specific Mustang that when they painted the spinner, which is the cone that fits over the propeller, they spray painted it blue, but they didn't mask off the propeller. So the propeller right near the cuff where the feathering mechanism for the propeller is, there's blue overspray on the propeller. It's a plane that might not survive its next combat mission. So they don't put a huge amount. Now, there are examples where this is not true, you know, because these are guys that are maybe not getting enough sleep. They're operating under conditions that are not ideal. They've got other things on their mind.
And it's not affecting the combat worthiness of this plane to mask off
exactly
certain areas or whatever.
The problem comes in, though, when you go to a contest or even just a casual, you know, people looking at it. If that overspray isn't done exactly right, it just looks like a mistake. There's a, I'm not going to say a fine line, but there's a, you have to sort of take all these things into account, a little windage in the how you apply these things so that it becomes clear that this was intentional and not a mistake. And like a D-Day, the invasion bars are another modelers because they're building a thing that sits on their desk and they have masking tape and all these fine details. Those lines are always, not always, there are guys that know this and get it and try to get this right. Those lines in a lot of cases were put on with mops and they're not very straight and they're not very clean because probably didn't have a lot of time to do them and they had 10 more planes sitting behind the one they're working on now waiting to get those stripes. Like, I love how they look when they're beautiful and straight and clean, but they really probably didn't look that way. And you can see it in photographs. There are some planes where they are very pretty and clean and straight. There are other ones where they're applied very haphazardly because they were done quickly.
Right. Just speaks to their moment in time.
When they exactly. Were. So I like to try to capture that within reason. Weathering is an art all to itself, and there's everyone has a different idea, but my idea is you want it to not ruin the model. You want the model to still look pleasing, but sort of capture these little flaws. And if you're looking at period photographs, you can see how things were, how things looked. Sometimes there's some issues of a lot of those photos were in black and white, and depending on the type of film they used, the colors that you see are not actually representative of the colors that were on the vehicle. There was a lot of controversy about reds and yellows. Let's just say that. And I have done what you're saying. I have freeze framed to try to look at, I have looked at photographs of the studio models to try to get the paint jobs right. I don't go as crazy as some people do. I do have studio scale models, but I haven't built them. Someday I will build one and then yes, the craziness will ensue. But
okay, man. So I have one more question for you. I actually have like 12 more questions, but we're going to have to bring you back on to do another episode if you're down, if you're okay.
Yeah.
So, because I want to talk to you about gaming and gaming miniatures and all this other stuff. My last question is, do you have any words of advice or any advice for people, students, people that are coming up, they like models, whatever, who are thinking they would like to try to break into the model making industry in film and television today?
One of the hardest things for people to do as a professional artist is I have to come in and work today, whether I want to or not. There was a saying painted on the wall at Imagineering, and I loved this, and I can't remember the name of the guy, but he was one of the original kind of Walt's right-hand man. And he, the quote was, you can't tell an artist how many ideas to have or when to have them. That quote is very good and insightful, but it doesn't quite hit the mark in a production sense because you pretty much have to tell an artist how many ideas to have and when to have them because you have a schedule. Like a lot of people are really, really talented. A lot of guys, like a lot of model builders I follow, super talented, super good, make amazing, amazing things. They could not do it 8 hours a day for 5 days a week. And sometimes it's 7 days a week if the production's falling behind. And sometimes it's 12-hour days or longer.
Okay, let me ask you this. If you don't have a portfolio, what do you suggest people do if they wanted to even, because to even try to get in, you've got to have something to show, right?
You have to have a portfolio. You have to.
I mean, I understand I'm putting you on the spot asking this question. And the bottom line is that this industry is shrinking. It's harder to get into. But at the same time, I'm generally of the notion to tell everybody, you know, if you want to try something, try it, you know, just try it, whatever, do your thing. Knowing all of that, if you had to tell your nephew who's 18 years old and they wanted to try to get into this industry, what would you tell them to try to put into a quote-unquote portfolio?
You need to build models of things that people recognize. You need to be able to make them as much as possible from scratch. You need to make them as quickly as possible. So the things that come into play are, it needs to look like the thing I want. It needs to be built in a pretty short time frame. It needs to be relatively clean. I'm going to use Leica again as an example. They never used anything off the shelf. That was an absolute no-no. So anything that was going to be in that film has to be bespoke, built for that purpose. A lot of times you won't get blueprints. You're just going to get a drawing. I've heard this and I've seen it myself, and it applies to sculptors as well. If you sculpt or scratch build or kit bash something that came from your imagination, that can show a lot of model building talent and the ability to make something and get proportions right, things like that. But if it's not matched to something that an outside observer can look at and go, okay, I know what that is, or I know who that person is, it's right. Not showing them what you're capable of.
That's an excellent, excellent piece of advice. I want to thank you so much for lending me your time, hanging out and talking. I can see already definitely a whole nother episode where we can talk about tabletop gaming and Warhammer and miniatures. And then I could even see a third episode where we talk about like techniques, actual model making techniques, which we yet didn't touch on at all. I mean, you mentioned some of them, but I mean, there's all kinds of stuff out there. Dude, you are a vast trove of information, Lord Hoffman.
Thank you.
It's true. But my last super, super duper quick question right before we go is this. Is airbrushing cheating?
It is.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. We're out. All right. I'm definitely going to have to invite John back for another round of conversation where we can actually talk about gaming stuff. But thanks again, dude, for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Again, you can find Hoffman on Instagram at talkaboutstarwars, those spaces, and links will be in the show notes at crymo.com. How about some hobby progress? This week, I don't know what I'm going to get done. I recorded this episode very early in the week, so yeah, I'm not sure. I'm fairly confident I will have finished up the red-colored Vargeist from GW. The other two, one green and one blue, have been posted on Instagram already. I used Army Painter's Anti-Shine Rattlecan Matte Spray for the first time. I like it. It's very similar to Tester's Dull Coat, but it comes in a bigger can and for not much more than the tiny Tester's can. And I recommend it. I feel the can is a little bit on the cheaper side. The nozzle tip came off when I popped the main lid off of it, but it easily sits back in the spout, no problem. I shook it for 4 minutes and put a couple coats on those Vargeist. They came out nice. I also primed up a handful of miniatures to paint next week. I used the airbrush, gave them some Zenithal coats. I've still got 5 of the Frostgrave Cultists / Necromunda House Cawdor conversions to knock out. But I was feeling like I needed something more, a little bit looser to splash some paint on. So I Zenithal primed up a couple of miniatures. I primed up 2 weird giant frogs from Reaper Bones Black and a thing called a Razor Mouth that's also from Reaper Bones Black. I just happened to see them at the hobby store. They were pretty affordable and I was like, these will be cool. Frostgrave actually calls for, at some point on the random monster table or random creature table, there are giant frogs that are supposed to come out on the board, and they'll be great for using with D&D or anything else. The weird razor mouth thing kind of looks like it used to be a frog, but now it's got a mouth that looks like a Stranger Things flower monster mouth sort of a thing. It's all full of teeth. I don't know, but it's kind of small, kind of like the size of like a squig from Games Workshop. So anyway, those should be pretty fun to paint up, and they can be kind of looser. I don't have to worry too much about, staying in the lines, so to speak. I also primed up a Reaper Bones Black Special Edition Zeba, the female Ifrit. She's pretty tall, kind of looks like she's like a 54mm figure. She's a great sculpt. She's got 2 swords, long hair, a flowy skirt, and of course, horns. And sharp teeth. I haven't decided what color to do her skin tones in. Typically, she's box art painted with super red skin. I'm not sure I'll go that route. We'll see. I also primed up some treasure tokens for Frostgrave. I've been meaning to prime those up. And I picked those up a while back on eBay from the company called Tiny Furniture. and they're really cool. Just little like 25 millimeter round bases with just different little bits of like coins or books or flasks or things like that that are treasure tokens. So next time we play, we'll have, you know, painted treasure. All right, on to Section Charlie. Section Charlie is where I get to highlight something or someone cool I found on the internet, and today's shout out goes to the YouTube channel Plasmo, Plastic Models. That's Plasmo-Plastic Models. That's not the actual URL. You won't be able to find it by typing that in there, but if you just go to YouTube, I want to say if you search for Plasmo, his channel will come up, but I did that and a different Plasmo channel came up. So anyway, I'll put links to his YouTube and Facebook pages in the show notes so you can get directly there. He's got quite a few subscribers. He's got just under 350,000 subscribers. So he's a big channel. On his Facebook page, it says that the model maker's name is David Damek. I'm for sure mispronouncing that. He's from Czechia, and he's a fantastic plastic model maker. He generally builds kits along with etched brass enhancements, you know, little add-ons that you get to customize kits. His YouTube videos are nice and calming to watch. They have sort of a Bob Ross rhythm to them, but in a very plastic modeling way. I know that sounds weird, but if you check him out, I'm sure you'll agree. Plasmo does excellent building and painting, and then he does full dioramas as well, and it just looks so good. What he does is, it's so clean and specific. It's just, man, his work is just awesome. Mostly he works on World War II vehicles, including planes and tanks, but he's definitely got a variety of projects to check out, including some sci-fi and some modern jets. Most recently, he did an Apollo 11 anniversary moon lander, and it's cool. I know how hard it is to make videos of any kind, and the simplicity and succinctness, that's a tough word, really means he goes to a lot of trouble to make something extremely watchable. So again, links to his YouTube and Facebook presence are in the show notes. All right, that puts a fork in this episode, the 13th. Thank you guys for hanging out. Best of luck with your hobbies, your art, your dreams, and your drives. Until next time, see ya.